Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tobin.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, I am feeling transgressive.
Oof, that's a nice feeling.
But I'm also feeling transgressive in Technicolor. Because today's guest's work is so bright and so joyous and so full of colour that I can't feel any other way. And I'm a real recent fan, actually. I recently discovered our guest's work through the gallery in London, White Cube, due to their very vibrant large-scale paintings. And then you are a very big fan. Yes. And have been telling me about shows at like Michael Cohen Gallery in America, and just the fact that there is big news, which we will reveal shortly in this episode, about a new exhibition which is just about to open in New York City in a public gallery. So that's extremely exciting. And today's guests are literally just pulsating with flamboyant colour, and I really think they're going to bring a lot of joy to people. But within them, the kind of context that surrounds them, and also the kind of the ideas behind the work, is a lot of ideas of kind of dismantling binary and fixed identity. So it's really of our time and of our moment. And I feel like today's guest is a really great person who's pushing forward kind of ideas of social change within their paintings. And it's really exciting. So we are very proud to welcome to Talk Art, Ilana Sabdi. Hi, Ilana.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. This is the only way I ever want to be introduced in any scenario of any kind. So thank you for that.
We can record it for you, and you can put it on your phone. So when it rings, you just get Ilana Sabdi coming up.
Exactly.
Where are you in the world, Ilana?
Currently in my studio in Bushwick in Brooklyn, New York.
So you're based in Brooklyn. You were raised between Columbia and Miami.
Yes.
How did you find yourself in Brooklyn?
So I moved to Miami when I was 13 and immediately decided I need to get myself to New York somehow at the age of 13. So I went to art school in Providence at RISD, and then, you know, sort of spent as much time as possible coming in and out of New York. So New York was always an end game for me. And, you know, I did sort of give it like the good college try in a few other places before I was like, no, it's New York. So I've been here for the past almost 13 years.
And why New York at that age? Like, what was it about the idea of New York versus obviously the reality when you moved there? But what was it the kind of that sang to you and spoke to your heart?
I mean, I think it was the mythology around just like the magic of New York. I think like the idea that everything came and melted together, and just, you know, it was sort of the misfits from everywhere could kind of come to New York and find a home. I do still believe that's true. It's just kind of the perpetual pricing out of said people, said misfits, is not quite the mythology of New York that I bought into at the beginning. But everyone I think here still is pushing through, because it is still, I mean, it still is a center of the art world, even though the art world has been quite decentralized, I think, through the internet and the ability to, you still have the amount, the excess of just like culture here that you can't quite, and variety. I think it's really important to me to be around all kinds of people that are comfortable being around all kinds of people. And I think that's becoming more and more of a commodity in this country than I would like.
Yeah.
Why do you think it is central for art and the art community? What is it about the city and especially Brooklyn? Because we talk to so many artists, and Bushwick in particular, there is a real artistic community there. Why do you think that that has been the place where everybody's kind of collected?
I can't really say exactly. I think it's, you know, the more cynical version of me thinks that galleries go where there's money, and money, New York is where a lot of people with money are kind of concentrated. And artists want to be where galleries are. So that's a kind of more cynical way that I look at it. But I'm here because other artists are here. Right. And because, you know, you throw a rock out the street and you hit like five incredible, brilliant artists that you've admired your whole life, you know? And I think that you can't, there are other places in the world that you find that. And, you know, I think if I had to leave New York, I'd go to any of these other places. But the concentration of it, I think, and the standards are pretty high for artists. So you really have to push yourself. And I like that. I respond, I'm a sponge to my environment. I respond to that.
So being a sponge to the environment and growing up, what was the art that you was a sponge for? How did you discover art where you're from? And what was it that was making you feel like that was a career that you could actually go to?
I mean, I blame it all on my mother. She, as a little kid, before I could speak, I was drawing. And so she immediately recognized that and exposed me to as much as possible. She always wanted to be go to art school, and her father kind of forced her to go to medical school, which was a totally different path. And then she kind of came back around, but art was always around my home, as much as, you know, especially I think when she realized that she could funnel it all through me when I was little. So, and I come from Barranquilla in Colombia, which is the birth of magic realism. So it's also something that was, I think I was exposed to surrealism before I was exposed to realism, almost. Like it was the language that perpetuated art forms around me growing up in a really organic way. So
can we talk about that? And it's a magic surrealism, you just said.
I'm not the expert in the difference between magic realism and surrealism, but I've always understood it to be more in literature, and surrealism a more visual, although maybe don't quote me on that, because there's obviously surrealist writers. But I was raised around these kind of alternative ways of looking at reality that weren't quite, you know, to not quite be content with reality as it was. And I think that was like my first introduction with.
And that's just because of the actual place you're from. That is the sort of themes that were around.
Gabriel Garcia Marquez is from Barranquilla. I think that was the style of writing that I was raised around in my home. My mom was always reading me from his or other writers of the same movement. And it was always very vibrantly colored paintings that were around me. So I think that like color has always just been a default. It comes from a very instinctive place because it was ingrained in me.
And also in a really basic way, like magic realism as writing or within art was about the kind of everyday, like real life, but then with magical elements. And it's this blurring of real life with fantasy, and that's right. Quite an interesting foundation block if you think about your work, actually.
Yeah, like magic is ingrained in the banal or in the sort of mundane.
Yeah.
which has always been like kind of like almost expecting it, and it's always kind of been something that draws me to different art forms. So surrealism, I think, was a really natural art form to be drawn to as soon as I was introduced to it.
What were you drawing as a kid? Was it similar to the work you're making now? Because there are so many artists that we talk to, and the work they were making as a kid is really their style going forward. It's expanded, obviously, and they've matured with it. But what the fundamentals are, the kernel of what they were working on, became their whole practice.
That's so interesting. So something really tragic happened, which is I was put in a little art class where the teacher would only allow us to copy other... I mean, I was really, really little. And the only way that we were allowed to make art was to copy these like Hallmark cards, like these stacks that she had, that in hindsight I'm like, I bet she was like reselling them because we weren't even allowed to keep them. So for a long time, it was like pushed out of me to do anything but mimicry, you know, as a child. But so I think like that, then I think something happens when something gets like pushed down from you. It kind of just like repels back out somewhere else. And it did, it came, you know, I work with every single possible ways of applying paint on a canvas in this moment and like make everything that shouldn't, you know, goes against the rules of like coexistence, coexist together. So I think it's probably somewhere deep in me, this like repressed way of wanting to make work.
Yeah. What was your mom's work like? What is your mom's work like?
Well, actually now my mom is a film critic. So she's sort of traveled through the
culture, everything in culture. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. She was a photographer for a bit. She's made some short films. So it's been more in the sort of time-based medium. But she was always painting when I was little. It was always around me.
And you grew up in a place called Barranquilla, is that right?
Barranquilla.
Okay. In Colombia. And were there like local institutions or galleries or museums that you would see or experience?
So not so much. No, I mean, I'm sure there are more now that I'm not aware of. But when I was little, that wasn't how I was. It was actually, so Barranquilla is the birthplace of the carnival, which is the Carnival of Colombia, which is the biggest or the second biggest carnival in the world, I think, after Brazil. And I would say that that was my introduction to art in a real way, more than anything else. I think it was like being surrounded by, I didn't recognize it as that at the time, but I think being surrounded by that amount of like, first of all, that amount of craft that goes into the making of costumes, the making of these kind of like very excessive and overabundant forms that exist in a carnival. And it was like my first introduction into like the uncanny, like the sense of something being like both something that both horrified me and fascinated me at the same time, that something was like really brightly colored, but also kind of speaking to something dark. You know, there's a lot of narratives in the carnival that are quite dark, which is true for all all carnivals.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
how old were you when you saw the carnival for the first time?
I don't remember. It was little.
And yeah, because they can be scary. I mean, I remember seeing things as a kid and being terrified. It's all the masks and the performative energy of it all and this and the noise and everything. But there was something about that that has stuck with you, that you've managed to kind of the essences of that you've put into your practice.
The essences of it, yeah. So I think that like I'm always kind of struggling with how to speak about the carnival and my work, because I don't really consider it any kind of like sort of journalistic approach or anthropological approach to the carnival as this kind of way to speak to it. But the ethos of it, the themes around it have absolutely embedded themselves in my psyche. And that comes out in my visceral responses now to anything. So I think just inherently, that's always going to be how I approach that. The thinking around the grotesque and mockery and forms of resistance and transgression through those modes of existing is absolutely something I root to the carnival.
It's almost like there's protest and activism within the carnival, even though it's entertainment and it's like people showing off their craft. There is really moments in there that are you're saying political and can be used to spread messages and protest. And that's something that we have the colors of the carnival in your work, but we also have this underlying sort of dread, I guess, or something in there that we can't quite put our finger on with your work.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think the carnival, there's different sort of narratives of it, different sections. Some of it was pulled from the Carnival of Colombia. I think probably Brazil would be really similar, and anything else in the Americas as colonized land would be really similar, which is like a collision of things that came from Europe and things that came from the indigenous communities of the traditions that were inherent to the land. And they kind of collided in the aesthetics and the performances as they did in real life, right? Like they tell these narratives of death and dance overpowering death. There's literally the figure of death and the figure of life, and life kills death. And it's like a whole, you know, there's also like a headless man that walks around with like blood dripping, and your little kids
so
are just
intense.
Like, throw it. It's really, it's like so Halloween,
intense.
You know?
Yeah.
And So all of that, I think, is like something that has influenced the kind of way that I approach seducing through performance, through color, through a kind of choreography almost in the paintings, to sort of tell, like, in an almost parasitic way, to kind of serve as an agent of change somehow, like to tell you something that you don't quite want to make you look at something you don't quite want to look at.
Yeah, I really like that idea that it kind of shaped the way you saw the world, you know, through this creativity that was surrounding you annually, or you know, however many times the carnival would take place. But also I'm interested in the kind of DIY nature of it all, because if you think of all those costumes and how they're so handmade, I guess that would have made a big impact, the idea that you can create something that theatrical, that impactful, out of very simple materials even, or out of nothing. You know, it's almost like a kind of magic in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's always been, you know, I tried to make sculpture for a bit when I was in grad school, and I had hard time. Yeah, I have a whole secret.
What is it like?
Practice that was, oh, it ranged a lot, because I had a really hard time with the engineering aspect of sculpture. Like I was always coming at it from the position of a painter and from the position of trying to discover something through making, and I would get really stuck in the ways of having to just make something stand or something, you know, like actually answering to the questions that sculpture provides as, like, you know, an object in space in a different way. And, but I was very into Eva Hess. So I was looking at a lot of, like, you know, the artists that were working with real bodily materials, but I really, I had some sculptures that were, I was working with resin and latex and silicone and
I was
of
hoping you'd say all these things, because that there's a real fleshy energy that I'm drawn to in your work. And when you see it on JPEG, and again, it's the age old thing that you have to see art in person for it really to make sense. But the surfaces of your work is like stitched flesh at points, and there's staining, and it feels like you were talking about latex and Eva Hess's work and everything, is that it has this like Hammer horror sort of feel, like flesh from Frankenstein's been peeled off and put on. That, and that is something that I find really enticing about your work, and you tactile, you want to touch it. How did that as a materiality enter your practice then? Was this from the carnival as well, or is this, would this have come through a different route?
I think, like, it's funny when I think about roots, I'm like, you know, it takes like conversations with a therapist sometimes to figure out, like, what's the root of the thing? You know, why do I respond to it?
That's us. That's why we're here. We're your therapist.
Right.
You're our therapy.
Time to change the name of the podcast.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned Frankenstein, because I sort of understand the thing that I'm drawn to when I collect all of these things that, you know, screenshots and little writing that I'll put on like a post-it or in my sketchbook or something. I'll collect all these things that fascinate me, and kind of like spread them out and try to understand what the threads are between them. And Frankenstein, one scene in the book where, you know, he builds this monster, and then he kind of sees, it sort of like turns the like life on in the monster and sees the blood flow through under the flesh. It's like the flesh was just a little bit, ever so slightly too thin, that he could see like life moving, and the horror that gave, that's sort of like how he, how this experiment became a monster. And it's like that, that tiny gesture of just like skin being slightly too tight, like body being slightly too large, just everything being slightly too much, the sort of space between familiar and unfamiliar that happened there was a huge inspiration for me with that's like, it's definitely come into this work, just that small moment in that novel. But it's really that kind of way of sort of collecting from all different sources, looking at the way animals engage in predatory prey behavior, looking at a lot of different parasites. I'm really interested in the parasite, like thematically and conceptually, and also just aesthetically, all the different kinds and how they behave in nature.
What's your favorite parasite? The tapeworm?
Such a nerd. Yeah, it's a tapeworm. It's a...
He's a legend. The tapeworm's a legend, yeah.
Bilharzia is this one that I actually is in my work a lot as like little baby versions of it and adult versions of it. And it just like, it's a worm, like, but it kind of has these like visible entrails And so it sort of like moves, and as it moves, it can be, sometimes it looks like a face. I'm obsessed with this, like, it's a really embarrassing thing to say out loud, but
But this lives within like animals or humans in the gut, or where does this parasite exist?
It's something that can be that infects the host through consumption. So they're called like trophically induced parasitism. They infect through the nutrition. So you would consume it, and it's found in like South America and parts of Africa, and I'm not sure where else. I've tried to not be like so scientific about it, but just like by researching it visually, I've become invested in what it is, how to find more of it. But it's really been, it's in almost all of my paintings, at least in one or two ways. Yeah. And I love the knowledge that someone's looking at something so sensual and so seductive and so almost ethereal sometimes, or really bodily, but it's a parasite. It's almost always a parasite.
Wow. But it's interesting because there is a theme within your work of transformation, and that parasite in itself, the way you described it, the way it can move and shape and grow, and there's like a younger version of it even, you know what I mean? There's like loads of different iterations.
Offspring, yeah.
It's almost like that symbolic. Yeah.
It's also the parasite as a concept, as an animal, is like an agent of change, right? Like it's a thing that like infects a host and forces it to change. It's sort of it's a foreigner that arrives as like a way to sort of threatens to infiltrate a larger body and destroy it from within. So there's something really transgressive about it as a concept, and it sort of brings in like narrative, like language around, you know, imposition and infection and like bad boundaries. And I go back to this reading by this author, Megan Milks, who wrote an incredible list of ways to, I think it was like how to write like a parasite, and it's something like that. But an incredible way to think about the parasite as like transgressive modes of existing. So they'll go through like these different ways of different parasites that, you know, this one like infects the host by taking over its tongue and becoming its tongue. So, you know, occupy the mouth with new hungers, you know, it's things like that, like different ways of actually like conceptually thinking about the parasite as modes of existing.
And if you think of like, you know, we were talking about carnival earlier, but if you're thinking about things like that, like in its very essence, it's the same as art in a way, like unifying people, bringing people together, edifying, evolving, like through the sensuality of art, through the seduction perhaps of an image.
Right.
You can change the way that people feel, but also bring people together. Because I feel like the core of something like carnival or even art, there is something about community or like, you know, people for a shared view of the world that you might be able to make it a better existence.
Right. Yeah. There's a way of like seducing almost from like underneath or maybe from like every angle, but this like form of seduction that's like, that's a way to kind of talk about something that is uncomfortable or difficult or maybe like too complex, too dark almost to speak through darkness. So we're going to speak about it through color or through excess or through dance or through, you know.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that is your work, because your work is incredibly seductive and it's a real like visual pleasure. It's flamboyant. The colors are amazing, but it's disarming them knowing that there is a parasite in there. But also at first glance, you might not realize that they are highly figurative. There's arms outstretched. There's feet pointed, limbs like pushing or reaching or trying to connect with another limb. These figures that are in there, they're like fragments of figures. Are they images or photographs, or is this all a memory exercise when you create your work?
It's a huge memory exercise, but I do have a tremendous amount of sources, and they are very, I like to think, quite surprising. And all of them come together in this, it's hard to name a singular way of, people often ask me how I start a work, and it always starts in a sketch, but it can be quite different each time. I think of points of tension. I think that's where I really start. Sometimes it's a singular action, or sometimes I saw something in a movie. Film is really impactful to me, and I saw maybe a scene in a movie where there was a pressure point, and I'm like that it stayed with me. So then I'll draw it a bunch of times, and then it'll either become something, it'll become the beginning of a larger painting, or it'll come in like much later sometimes as this like way to kind of realize something in a work. But sometimes the sketch starts with just purely formal, you know, very much about composition, and then the figuration will come in. But figuration is very much a part of thinking through this work. It's usually where sometimes I think there's a lot of bodies in the work, but they're not always human. Sometimes they're bodies that become real estate for other bodies. Sometimes it's not quite, the body might just serve as a joint to connect two forms that are not bodies. So it's really like breaking apart and putting back together what it means to take up space and have a body in the world, and who gets that privilege, and who gets to like do it in an uncontained fashion. And, you know, how does spilling out of a container better define, I don't know, just like these really like abstract questions about what it means to have a body.
No, I think it's, you've described it as having like a leaky identity as well. Mm-hmm. This feels like an identity that doesn't feel fixed. And queerness for you is a major theme in your practice, as something that you are exploring. And almost you've described it as the paintings are mocking binaries. It's like this ability to talk about identity and politics, gender politics, queerness, in a really abstract way. It's so beautiful.
I think it's, you know, I like to think of mocking binaries, like including the binaries of good and evil, right? Like binaries within religion, binaries. So it's like the concept of a binary as anything being fixed is, you know, to mock it, to question it, to challenge it is a queer experience, but I think it's a universal problem, right? Outside of what we consider queerness. I think like that's my entry point into understanding what it means to be human and to have the conditions of being human. The desire, I think like something that I consider a very queer experience, but is also quite universal, is the idea of like desire and longing without resolve.
Well, that's interesting. So the paintings aren't resolved. Sorry to jump in there. They never feel resolved for you.
They're never, there's no way to follow a singular path without it being rerouted. You have this like almost athletic, I have this almost like athletic way of like rerouting things in the painting, yes, that will never quite resolve something. And I think a lot about like resolution in different ways, resolution in terms of image, because image is a huge part of, I think about relating to the world through image. And so never quite, you know, I'm a tactile, now I'm like going all over the place. I'm a person that like understands the world through touch and through tactility, but I also relate very much to it through image. I'm not sitting here kind of touching the parasite. It's all through image. So how does that kind of become this desire and longing without resolve? Because I never, you know, I'm always, there's always a disruption from the lack of complete resolution through image. And so all of these, yes, conceptual questions become visual problems that I like to create for a viewer too. You can't quite follow a singular body in the work because it's never going to finish. It's never you're like, that's definitely a human because that's a human finger, but then it never quite finishes human. And it was never, maybe it was never human to begin with. And that hand is actually a cartoon. And so then it's actually just line. And so there's all these questions of, you know, making something so elastic that it undoes itself.
I think it, for me, it's the performative nature of your work, and that there's this constant movement. You're talking about switching and changing up. And a lot of like abstract paintings that I spend time with, you find yourself in moments of pause within the work. I like to hang out in a certain area. I like that color. I can chill there. I can enjoy them, that surface there, that brushstroke. With your work, it's an enjoyable experience, but you can never quite pause. You're always darting around. And I think that's your use of color, which I'd love to get onto and talk about. But I think it's the materiality. But I think it's also this energy that is that you've harnessed, that you're able to put into a painterly surface.
Yeah, I think it's, I always think of the painting as this kind of, you know, these paintings deal with power, right? They speak to themes of power, oppressive power, and internal sort of power dynamics in the private and the public. So there's a lot of themes around that. And I think like the relationship that I have to the way I make the painting deals very much with my agency as an artist and my kind of trying to command a material that doesn't quite want to respond the way I want it. So there's this like act of like, there's this kind of power dynamic.
Dance. Yeah, like a dance.
Yeah, like a dance or like a power play or you know, something where there's like the material wants to respond to gravity and I'm trying to kind of push it. So there's this really bodily way of making the work. And I like to say it sort of uses, when I work in the scale that I love to work at, which is large, it uses all my joints. It uses my wrist, my elbow, and my shoulder to make a full gesture sometimes. And so it's a way to kind of dart you from one side to the other in this, yeah, like this really like athletic fashion sometimes.
And you work on the wall?
I go back and forth, depending on the size of the painting. If it's, because I have to work on panel when I work with some of the material with the wax and some of the materials I work with. So it's hard to put it, it's hard to like lift it on my own. And so that alone will shift the amount of time I spend like, you know, working. But there's a lot of pores that happen that are fundamental to this work. And so at the very least, the paintings will start on the ground and then they go on the wall.
Or for a pour of paint, for a pour of whatever the material is.
Yeah, I'm usually pouring paint to start the works. Yeah.
Is the floor like messy? Does it go everywhere? Or what do you put down? How do you protect all that? Yeah.
I don't. I've tried so many times and then I've realized that just surrendering to the fact that like I will probably lose part of my security deposit. That's a material cost in the work. Because I can't be thinking about that. It's so fast. I'm fighting against water tension and you know, like I'm fighting against gravity. Like I can't be thinking about protecting a floor.
And because of the kind of abstract nature of the work, even though it has all these figurative elements, often when I've looked at the work, I see things that trigger some memory to me from something else. And I know that films plays a big role, and there's numerous artists that have kind of impacted you. But I also read that it was the drama of Baroque painting. I really liked that very specific description, like the drama of Baroque. I loved that. Can you speak to that a bit?
Yeah, I think it's, I love thinking about it as like the melodrama of the Baroque, right? Like I look to a lot of Rubens paintings and the way that they, you know, the way he used bodies to, many bodies to describe almost a singular form, and the way sort of things ascended and descended. And it was always through the kind of, like the turn of a muscle and the turn of a arm, and nothing quite, it did feel like you could very easily like kind of dissolve that, those engagements and in the work into like, I guess, twist and turn them into something else, which was always just like a desire I had with looking at that work. But it's the sort of the highest form of, you know, if you think of like folklore in a carnival, it's almost like low art, right? Like people, you know, there's a desire to not take it seriously as an art form. And then you think about the sort of Baroque painting and the Baroque architecture and the sort of history of the Baroque as like high form of drama, but they're both kind of doing similar things. So having them as like influences that coexist feels like exciting, and it feels transgressive. It feels like something that, it's almost like bringing high art low to the ground so you can like touch it and poke it and kind of make fun of it and just pervert it a little bit.
I like that word. And also then Helen Frankenthaler and Francis Bacon, you've like had a splice. People have compared you to kind of pulling from both of those art heroes of yours as well. Are they art heroes, those two?
Yeah, I think, I've never really been one to have like singular art heroes. And I've thought about it a lot because I get this question often. I think it's almost like finding ways to make these things, again, like coexist, or these influences coexist and intersect. And but yeah, the sort of horror of Francis Bacon is absolutely a huge, you know, the bodiliness of a Frankenthaler painting, the absolute audacity of them, I think, is really exciting to me. And Eva Hesse is a huge one for me, and what she was able to do in a short time with the sort of like, quote, like offensiveness of the body, and bring that into paint, into abstraction in a way that was, I think, like had never quite been seen. We used to, Some friends of mine in grad school were just, we would just constantly say, like, Eva Hesse is God. I think we put that on a friend's birthday cake one time, like, Eva Hesse is God. Like, there was just something about when I was in grad school, all of us were talking about Eva Hesse, even the fact that those works are disintegrating. And there's something so powerful in that, too, that has always been a huge, yeah. She's, and then a big one for me has been Linda Benglis for similar reasons. And actually, there's some Linda Benglis wax pieces. The Yale Gallery had two of them, and I would just sit in front of them for hours, like, how did she do this? And I think that is what started me working with wax, like trying to figure out how Linda Benglis did that. And I think I just like did a whole different thing, and it went its own path. But
this is beeswax. That's a material that you use. Is that something that will disintegrate over time, like Eva Hesse's work, or is that quite a solid material once you put it into a painting?
I mean, I don't really know exactly. I haven't seen this treatment of, I'm working with encaustic and beeswax, and I think encaustic has been around since, you know, you see the Egyptian portraits in encaustic, like the ancient Egyptian one. So I think the longevity of this is, I think, is like a question for sure. But I haven't seen this treatment, so I'm sort of here with everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen it before, and it's a very unique pictorial language that you have, and you have like oil and acrylic, but then there's this beeswax in there, and you've said that I want to have as many different ways as possible of applying paint. And you were saying about the pour, and then at one point you have to go up. So what is the process of your paintings? Or is this like a top secret thing that no one should know about?
It probably should be top secret, but I don't know. I'm not very good with secrets. So I think a big thing that makes these works exciting is that in the making of them is that I actually prime the canvas differently according to an original drawing. So so there is a kind of blueprint that I start with, and then that allows for, I think, the first real stage of painting in the work is when I do these pours with acrylic where I kind of tilt the canvas in different ways to kind of make the water and the acrylic kind of travel throughout, and it completely shifts the original plan. It sets the terms that I'm then going to have to follow for the rest of the painting that are very much, I think that's a huge place where I start to be, where I start this kind of power play with the painting. I'm trying to control something I can't quite control. And if I ever try to fake it, it never quite comes out. It has to be a really organic kind of process-based aspect of the painting.
How would you fake it then? In what way? You've tried?
Like if I tried to move it in the direction I wanted it to move, you're going to be able to tell that this, it won't have that sort of slow moving travel of pigment. That's what I'm after. So the pigment travels throughout the painting with the water and adheres to the differently treated surfaces throughout. And that's
glacial, isn't it? Like a glacial drift.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Nice. Like a glacial, that's a really good way to put it. And because of the speed of that travel and the way that it adheres differently, it creates this kind of illusion that I'm really like, one of the artists I look to a lot is Charlene von Heil. She has this like completely indecipherable way of painting. You can't quite understand the sequence of events. And that's, I think she gets a lot of pleasure in that. I get a lot of pleasure in that. So I think that some of that probably happens in this stage. And then it's about responding to the decisions that the you know, gravity made at the beginning and that I was fighting against. And it's responding to those gestures and the sort of going back and forth between an original sketch and the decisions that process makes as you kind of get through a work like this with this many intricacies. It's a place of real strategy in the making of the painting, which I enjoy. I can never really like surrender to this painting. It's always tumultuous.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What was your journey like to today? Because obviously you've become incredibly successful. You know, you're represented by international galleries. You're about to have a really big museum show, which we can talk about in a second. But what was your kind of student years like, and the kind of, you know, becoming Ilana Savdi, you know what I mean?
I love that way of putting it too. The diva in me is just loving. I think it's, I went through a lot of different mediums. I was always a painter, always drawing. And I tried really hard to be anything but, you know, I tried to have like a legitimate job with like legitimate career paths. And, you know, I graduated from RISD in 2008, which was the recession, you know, peak recession year. And so I was like anything to get a job, like anywhere, you know. And so I taught myself graphic design, and I pretended like I was designing all these websites for all these major things and would submit them as like portfolios. I was trying anything. I worked in photography for a while, and I ended up for a little bit doing retouching for like within the beauty industry, retouching stock photos or retouching. I worked at like Maybelline. I worked at, you know, different like beauty companies. And then a lot of that ended up becoming just source material for painting after work. Like I always had a studio. I would kind of bring a lot of that back. So for a long time, the paintings would start from digital sketches, because I was kind of, I think it was the rage that I felt in retouching like a model to look like this idea of sort of stock or norm or perfection or something, where trying to create something that was so unnatural and that was supposed to be this kind of utopia, right? The desire to pervert that with the same tools that I was supposed to be using to perfect it, like started to drive a lot of the work. So I started to make these paintings that were based on stock photos that had been completely distorted and, you know, disrupted with color, disrupted with the, you know, the digital tools that were used to create them in the first place, and liquefying them all. And I think this was, you know, I've just described really quickly, like a course of sort of 8 years, but that was the work that I ended up using to apply to Yale and went to grad school with that body of work. And then when I was in grad school, it was the sort of very big distance between the stock photography stage and the final painting that didn't quite, there was like something really missing in that intermediary state, which is unraveling of the body. And I would realize that that interest was getting lost. That fascination was getting lost. And I started to play with materials that felt like they were more reminiscent of the body, but also had this kind of toxicity to them. And that's where like resin and latex and silicone and that whole, which led me to the sort of K-hole of like, you know, feminist art history. And so I think in grad school, I really kind of unraveled all of that. And it was really difficult. It was a really difficult time for me because I was failing a lot. I was failing a lot with this work. And it was always public. I was failing in front of like some, you know, of my like heroes that would, you know, people that would, I was destroyed in crits in grad school in a very public way. And I remember someone was like, you're like, we had like superlatives at the end, and someone was like most likely to rise from the ashes, because they would just like tear me to shreds. And then I would always come back with a whole new body of work, you know, 3 months later for the next crit. And it was really tough, but it forced me to dissect it all, to break it all open. It was a really incredible experience in the end.
Reborn over and over again.
Yeah, basically. And all of that is in this work. Every single stupid decision I made in the studio, every single time that like I did something, then someone, you know, and you're an exposed nerve the entire time you're in grad school. So if someone like walks by and doesn't linger long enough in front of one piece, you're like, well, that piece is trash then, you know, and you're so vulnerable. And then, but collecting all of those failures and really trying to understand them is what fundamentally led to this work.
It really is like ashes, though, isn't it? It's like all of these kind of burnt remains in a way. And it's interesting as well, like there's a big phenomenon at the moment of people, because, you know, like things happen in not trends, but like there's a kind of consensus that happens, especially within art or philosophy first before everyone else catches on. And at the moment I've noticed about three exhibitions on the idea of the unruly body, and also books coming out now even by friends of ours, like Emma Dabry's written one, and there's a show at the Wellcome Collection in London. So this idea of the unruly, it also seems like your work is really connected to that.
Yeah, I think very much about the sort of container that some of us feel like we've been forced in, and like lately continue to be further forced into, and spilling out and leaking out of the container is kind of the only way to define it. You know, it's the only way to really understand it when you touch all of its edges. And so to make something that's supposed to be impenetrable, like porous, I think is, yeah, it feels like a transgressive act. It feels like something that you're not supposed to do. You're not supposed to be here. You're not supposed to say these things. You're not supposed to speak this way. You're not supposed to do any of this. You're fundamentally, by even making art, you're not, you know, you're doing something transgressive. So it's just leaning into that, I think, is really important.
For me, it's also the idea of correction, though, because like if you think of all those images you were manipulating for different beauty brands to make the perfect image, it's like this idea that everything else is somehow not valid and incorrect. You know, that idea of correction, I just can't bear it. Like a Tippex pen over humanity.
Yeah, it's not, but that's the thing. It's the unbearable. It's the thing that I always think about it, like in horror films, when like, if you ignore the monster is going to get really, really, really big, you know, and eventually you won't be able to ignore it. This blob is going to take over the town, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what's happened. That's what's happened to every, you know, that's what happens with COVID, it's happened with the AIDS crisis. Like you can't ignore the thing that demands your attention. And I think that's true for many of us that aren't supposed to exist, you know?
Mm. Do you see your work as a political act or activism or a Trojan horse in some ways? There's a message encoded in there that people don't realize that they're actually looking at.
Yeah, I would like to think of it a bit more as a Trojan horse. I think I feel weary of talking about my work in the sense of activism, because I think I would insult many activists who, you know, their paintings that are being sold to, you know, I don't know. I challenge that a lot. I have a lot of conflicting feelings about what it means to make more objects in a world that doesn't need more objects, and to, you know, yeah, I don't know. I have a, you know, to make objects out of wax, which means they have to be like climate controlled, and so, you know, I'm like, I contradict, and if I think about it too much, it makes me not want to make work, so I can't think about it too much. Wow. but it is really important to me that I am a political person, and I am a politicized person, so it is impossible for them not to be political works. Because I can't speak to, you know, I think the most recent paintings I made in the past 4 months, and we saw in the past 4 months like the most horrific attack that we've seen in a long time in this like sort of lockstep way in this country against people that are me and my people, among just like, you know, we've been seeing this for years, and I think it's just like I'm having this kind of visceral response. I think this work is like a dissection of my own visceral response to these things that are happening
in
our time.
Yeah. I also just really strongly feel that art is such an important space. You know, even like if you have an exhibition of paintings, it creates this kind of space that can change everyday realities for people who see the work. And that's what I think is so important. And I was reading yesterday Xavier Dolan's really beautiful text that he did actually on Instagram, but he was talking about giving up making films and giving up, I think, acting. He might, you know, direct series perhaps, but it sounds like only because he's already committed to them. But it sounds like he literally after 15 years wants to just stop, because he wants to focus more his energies on perhaps activism. That's kind of subtly what it seemed to say, like maybe even eco-activism. I wasn't totally clear, but I really respected what he was saying. But at the same time, I was like, yeah, but all those things he made, they've sort of, like we said before, unified, edified, created a space for lots of people in small towns where there's no one else like like them to feel seen, yes, and to empower those people. And that's what I think the power of art is. I actually just wrote a text for this annual in the UK called Walpole, but I was talking about how art like illuminates the path ahead. You know what I mean? And like, it's not only reflecting, it's not, I described it as a bellwether. The art's like a bellwether for where society is. But the truth is, it's actually more about where we're heading to. And that, yes, and I think we collectively, as art lovers, as artists, as filmmakers, as whoever we are creatively, even makeup artists, whatever, like, I just feel like all of those people are somehow trying to create this better reality.
Yeah, there's I think, which is why I said, if I think about it too much, I have to stop thinking about it, because there is something, you know, you can undo anything in your head before you start it. So it's, there is such a thing, I think, as like, as overthinking something. But at the end of the day, I'm in my studio by myself as an exposed nervous system. And from that, I make work. And there is, I am of the belief that that undoubtedly will, or at least like in the hopes that when this work goes up on a wall and someone's standing in front of it, that they become an exposed nervous system. And there's this kind of space of vulnerability, of connection, that, I don't know, this kind of connectivity that I think you don't, that I think we need. And whether that is about pushing something forward, or that is about, like, you know, taking someone out of a space of ambivalence, I think is really fundamentally where the desire comes from, maybe, or having the ability to just, having the ability to be vulnerable in a time where we're just so fatigued that we can't access that vulnerability as much. So the studio becomes an enclosed space in which I can be in that state of vulnerability. And then the paintings are sort of this register of that.
Do you feel vulnerable in front of the paintings when the exhibition is on? Do you feel exposed by them?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you?
I feel like I feel like I've put up my own naked body everywhere and everyone's sitting there. Yeah, it's extremely vulnerable. It's extremely raw. And I think the fear is to ever get to a place where that stops being true.
You will always search to be uncomfortable with your work out there in the world. And that for you is something that would drive you to keep making the work.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's really important to be in the position where you can fail publicly, where that is, that you're, it won't kill you. You won't die. You will, you know,
that's because you've been critiqued so many times that you're like, I've been there. I know what this is. Go on then.
Absolutely.
Do it. And I'll just come back with something else. I'm all right.
Like, hit me. Like, it already happened. And in a, you know, the gladiator pit of grad school. No, I mean, I think it's, I strongly believe that from failure, like failure and shame are really important kind of places of, it's like, I feel like failure is a really important space for resistance to happen, for something, for growth to happen, to like arrive at a kind of divinity almost. Like, I think it's a really queer experience to exist in the world from a place of failure. And I think there's like a whole field of, I know there's like a whole field of study around the queer art of failure, because it's a space where, you know, you've already kind of fundamentally failed from the, from the get-go. You failed. So
you're
from
inconvenient,
there,
aren't you, from the start? You're like,
Exactly. You enter into the world inconveniently. And so everything else from there, you know, doesn't have to adhere to anything predetermined, because you've already failed at the first predetermined thing. So I think that that's how I kind of enter into the idea, but I think it is, again, universal. It's a really important space that leads to like interrogation, and it leads to evolution and change and transformation.
How long does a painting take?
So I have to work on many of them simultaneously.
Oh,
because
you work on multiple.
Yeah, because there's a lot of, I have to sort of respond to different drying times. There's a lot of masking out of different areas of the work and layering. And so, but I would say it would take me about a month to make a painting, but I can make about 2 or 3 in a month. So if I work on them simultaneously, so it depends on how much sleep I want to get, how many weekends I want to take.
Got it.
Yeah.
So we have got an exhibition that's just been announced that's opening for you, called Radical Contractions, which will be at the Whitney Museum of Art in New York, which is one of my most favorite museums in the world. But also the space within there is a free space for the public to enter. Most of the Whitney, you have to get a ticket. It's ticketed. You have to have membership. But you can go to the gift shop and you can go to this lobby gallery, which is, again, one of my most favorite spaces. I discovered Toyin Ojiodatola there, Salman Tor, mm-hmm. who's been on Talk Art, had an exhibition there. This is a career-changing space and a real big moment for you. It's a space dedicated to showcasing new work from emerging American artists. That's a lot of pressure. That's very exciting. How are you feeling about that? And how did that all come about for you? Congratulations, by the way. It's just like amazing.
Thank you. I'm really excited about it. I've been, I think the Whitney as an institution has been fundamental to my, you know, education as an artist. And so it's obviously, it's a dream. And I've also discovered artists from that space. That's one of my favorite galleries of any of the museums. It has like, it sort of invites this kind of singular move. And I think like, I love watching how people respond to it. So yeah, it came about because Marcela Guerrero, who's the curator, one of the two curators of this show, the other curator is Angie Arbeláez, who's, I think this might be her second show at the museum. So it's been a really exciting process to work with both of them. And I met Marcela when she acquired one of my works from the show I had at Michael Cohen Gallery.
This was in 2021, Occupy the Mouth, I think that was called, yeah.
Yes,
now
Occupy
part
the Mouth,
of the
which
collection.
Is
yes, great.
That's now part of the collection that actually came from that with that piece of writing about the parasite that I was telling you about. Occupy the Mouth with
the
New Hungers.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. It was one of my favorite pieces. I mean, I was so excited that was going to the Whitney. I didn't even believe it was real. I just telling them the other day, I did not believe it was real until it went through every single acquisition meeting it had to go through, and until the check was in my hand. This is a very Jewish thing about me. Until the check was in my hand. I didn't believe that this was real. I wouldn't celebrate it. I wouldn't tell anyone. Nothing. But yeah, after that, from that, that's how I met Marcela. And then she came to me a few months ago. And I think that space is reserved for shows that have like a, you know, I think it takes many years for a museum to plan a show. So they kind of have reserved that gallery for shows that are more contemporary. So I think that's why they kind of feel so vibrant with every show. And she approached me a few months ago, and we started with the idea of taking some loans for the show. And then as I started working on, it was too short of a timeline to make a whole new show. But then as I started working on the paintings, I was like, no, I'm going to make a whole new show. They just started pouring out of me. There was a lot that I wanted to say. I didn't want to split this show up. And there was a lot of works that I had in my mind that I was like, if I just kind of tuck myself into the studio and really, really push it, I think I can do it. And we'll see. I think I did it, but we'll see.
How many works are there going to be in the show? And this is paper as well as paintings.
Yes. So a huge part of this practice, a fundamental part of this practice, is the works on paper, which we didn't really talk about that much, but I see them as a very fundamental sort of alphabet that builds the language to this work.
But these
work.
Aren't and sketches in your sketchbook. These are actual separate from...
No, they're separate. So from the original rough sketch, I'll usually go to a work on paper that's monochromatic. It's just pen and acrylic and water. And that's where I kind of make a lot of the decisions that are around how one form connects to the next, like thinking about mark making, thinking about gesture and this really kind of small scale, you know, I'm not really considering color. And I think before it gets to any kind of real finished state, when I kind of have a real understanding of what are the fundamental forms that are going to guide the painting, I'll take a photo of it quite roughly and put it on Photoshop. And then that becomes where I sketch the painting is on Photoshop. That's where I bring in some of the source imagery that becomes a collage element in the work. And then these works on paper will get finished separately as their own piece. And I think that it allows for the painting to also sometimes become a sketch for the work on paper, where I then some of the things that happened in process-based decisions in the painting will inform some of the decisions I make to finish the work on paper. So they aren't sketches for the paintings, but they do have this kind of interplay with the work. And I don't think I've yet had a show of these paintings that doesn't also have works on paper in the show.
And how many paintings and how many works on paper will you have? Do you know?
So I have 7 works on paper. They're small, and they're going to introduce the show. So you kind of, you know, have to earn the paintings. And then I have 6 10-foot paintings in the show. It's going to be quite an excessive, a very abundant. A
flamboyant. That's going to be hot color everywhere.
I keep thinking you either are going to love the show or you're going to hate the show. But there's no ambivalence here. You can't have no opinion. And yeah, I was thinking very much of this kind of like almost cathedral-like way of presenting, you know, these kind of large windows or large kind of frescoes or something really kind of excessive and tumultuous and like kind of being surrounded by them.
But it also sounds like the urgency to make them, that need that you were talking about where you were suddenly like, actually, I've got to make this. That would lend itself, I imagine, to having them installed that way.
Yes. Yeah. I think when I saw the first, it was just going to be three of these large ones. And when I saw them together, I realized they really need to live together. And it's a small gallery. It's a gallery that calls, like I said, for a really singular move. And I think that this way of putting these works in it feels like a kind of singular move. And I've never had the opportunity to make a show where the works were all the same scale. So you're not sort of, you have the desire to look at them kind of together. And I think rather than kind of contending with each of them at one, like singularly, you want to kind of consume them together and then kind of get lost in them. And it becomes more about the moments within each work. You know, it's hard to sort of step that far back from these large works in a smaller space. And I kind of like that. I think that's an exciting new way to look at this work that I haven't had the opportunity to do yet.
When does the show open?
It opens on the 14th of July.
Whoa. So all the paintings have left the studio. They're all there now, right? When do you start installing?
They're all, well, I'm in New York, so they didn't really need to be like storing the work. So they're all still here, but all packed up, and they're getting to the museum on Monday and they're getting installed that same day. We start next week. Yeah.
I was going to ask if you're nervous, but I'm sure you're probably looking forward to feeling anxious because that's a feeling that you want around the work and that whole experience.
I'm nervous. Yeah, I'm very nervous, but I'm also, yeah, I'm excited. And I'm mostly nervous about keeping the, when I have the paintings in my studio, there's still these like living bodies that I can affect at any moment. Mm-hmm. I need them out of the studio so that they can become art, so they can become objects in the world that are someone else's responsibility.
That's really interesting. So when they're in the studio, you don't see them as art yet until they're
blurred. No, I misspoke. I see them as art, but I don't see them as objects in the world yet. They're still just my own. You know, I can kind of.
But they belong to you, I guess. And once they're out in the world, they're no longer yours. They're the world's.
Yeah, I'm not precious with them when they're in the studio. I'm like, you know, I'm constantly poking and prodding at them and not handling them with white gloves. Like I need someone handling them with white gloves so that they can. So I need them to leave.
How does it feel like to sell? Because you're a very in-demand artist. Your work, your shows sell out. What does that feel like to have that sort of pressure, to have to be really kind of hot and for people to be really like clamoring to get works by you?
It's terrifying. Yeah, because I think I have a very, I always call it a very Jewish anxiety that my mother ingrained in me to never, you never quite experience joy. You never quite let it. you're never quite gonna let, as soon as something exciting is going on, you're like, well, but it's, you know, everything that goes up must come down, you know, like you have that. So I have, me and my therapist speak a lot about enjoy the moment and that kind of thing. No, but I think the pressure is, I love the ability to connect with people through the work, and I have this huge privilege to be able to do that in this moment, and I'm trying to take advantage of it, and at the same time leave it out of the studio. Like any kind of demand, any kind of request, I have the first thing I did when I sold the first show was hire a part-time studio manager who's my absolute favorite person in the world. So she is the one that communicates with people via email so that I don't have other people's voices in my head when I'm in the studio. And it's very much about still staying in that space of discomfort, having the ability to make decisions that aren't impacted by the market, like not really, you know, people are always trying to, I see people trying to like slowly kind of embed little worms in your head about competition with other artists and, you know, create the little drama that people want to, yeah, to try to get you know, this person sold for this much. And like, you know, now at an auction, they're not selling for as much as they were selling before. So, and I'm like, that doesn't, none of that is in the studio. None of that is allowed to enter into the thinking around this work. And because of the fact that at the end of the day, when these works go up on a wall, they feel like my naked body on a wall. Mm-hmm. So I have to honor that feeling and not cut it up into little pieces and sell them for the highest bidder, you know?
Yeah, just with art,
you have to think about legacy and you have to think about the longevity. And if you really hear all those little parasites getting in your ear, these worms, it keeps you just on the daily with the practice, doesn't it? I guess instead of thinking about like the future, because you're going to paint for the rest of your life, obviously.
Right. I don't want to be sitting in the studio strategizing my career. I want to be sitting in the studio making paintings and thinking about those paintings and then block out time to strategize career stuff, because obviously you have to, because the idea is, how do I get to keep making paintings for the rest of my life? But not really having, you know, there's a lot of, you know how the art market kind of is and how it is different from what it was before with contemporary artists and the speed with which people get like chewed up and spat out. And there's so much of that. And you see it with like, you know, certain identities that are getting kind of exploited sometimes. And, you know, the language that people want to just like force upon you so that you can fit a certain trend. And so staying really vigilant about all of that is really important to me, because it's not something I want to participate in. I see the longevity, you know, if my body allows it, I'd like to stay doing this for a long time. So
if you keep the market per se out of the studio, what do you allow in the studio? Do you play music? Do you have snacks? Like what is your daily experience?
I have lots of snacks.
what's Nilana's snack of choice?
Lately it's been Twizzlers. I don't know if this should be on the It's so embarrassing. Because there's so much strategy that happens in these paintings that I never quite get to just like surrender to them. And there's not a lot of this painting that's meditative or anything. It's really you have to be quite present. So the only thing that really works to keep my ADHD in check is having like a TV show playing in the background at all times. Something I've already seen that I don't really have to focus on, but when it's an audiobook or if it's a podcast where I'm actually like invested in what I'm listening to, it kind of takes me away from the painting. Wow. So I've had to reserve those for only certain areas of the painting that are going to, you know, and only in some paintings am I able to do that. But mostly it's like a TV show or...
What cartoons did you watch growing up? Because it feels like there's a lot of a Nickelodeon energy in your work. Rocko's Modern Life. Ren and Stimpy. Love Ren and Stimpy. There's so much and Stimpy, like them extreme close-ups of like a ball sack or something where you'd be like, and that noise. It's like that because I feel like we're
horrifying.
The same. I'm 81, I think you're 86.
86, yeah.
So I think we're like 90s cartoon babies.
Absolutely.
Rugrats. I think it's all...
I've actually literally painted Ren and Stimpy into these paintings a few times. So
obsessed.
I'm a huge fan of... I think the cartoons are another thing that was just ingrained in me. I wasn't trying to deep dive research, like, you know, high research academic level of the cartoon strategies, but just like what it means to use line to like just like three or four gestures to imply something extremely grotesque about an exaggeration of the body. What does it mean for something to never quite die, but always almost die, explode, like, you know, be really elastic, like, be pulled apart by, you know, an anvil that, like, you know, whatever. There's always something. And in the most recent work, I've been thinking a lot about the kind of portals of cartoons, the way holes exist in cartoons and they become portals and ways to move through space, the way, you know, a tunnel gets painted on a rock and then all of a sudden, like, one can go through it, but the other one can't. You know, these, like, really...
through. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So they're just really, yeah. And I, yeah, definitely growing up and with, like, I saw this documentary about Nickelodeon a couple years ago that talked about how at the time it was so new that they were just letting the animators go nuts. Like they didn't really control what they were doing so much. So they like, this is like what happens when artists take control of all of the decisions and they really impact it and they embedded themselves in our psyche. And
yes.
So we definitely respond to grotesque silliness.
That's so interesting that Ren and Stimpy is a huge element of your practice, because I'm obsessed with Ren and Stimpy. Growing up, I had like all the Marvel comics. I was obsessed with the cartoon. I had the figures, the toys, everything. And I can absolutely see that in your work now, which makes me love it even more. That's so cool.
Oh yeah, the way, like the casual way that they just like will open up their chest to reveal the inside. It's just like open up their flesh reveals the inside of their body. It's just like really casual grotesque, like really casual discomfort. Yeah, that has the absolute, and I love colliding that with, you know, like a soutine level meat, right? Like that kind of both of those ways of considering the bodies are simultaneously feel really interesting and wrong, you know, like they're not supposed to coexist. So it's the power of being able to make them live in the same world is interesting.
I love that. Well, we're going to get on to our final questions now, Alana. This has been incredible. Thank you so much for your honesty and clarity with how to talk about your work and your practice. It's been incredible. So thank you. The first question we have is, if you could do an art heist, you could have any work of art in the world for yourself, what would it be and why? And I want to ask if you do trades with artists in Bushwick. Is this something that you, because there's a real art community, do you ever do swapsies with other artists?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I do trades. I haven't had a lot of work to trade recently, but it's something I'm actually blocking out time to make some works to trade, because I did a lot of that in grad school. And so my home is full of, but it's actually funny because I knew this art heist question was going to come. And so I was talking about it last night with a friend, and we found ourselves like being like, well, you know, it has to fit in like the apartment in New York. So we were like strategizing as if it was like, we were like overcoming the logistics of how to get this piece like
on a
plane to New York.
It's very, very serious.
So I guess I have like the one answer, which is pretty like my kind of basic goth girl coming through, but Saturn devouring his son, I think is just, I could look at that horror show forever. Or The Witch of Sabbath, I think is another one that has the more eeriness of all his kind of the whole series of like the witches and the paintings around. I think it was like dealing with like the like look, thinking about times of war through that. But really it goes always back to that, you know, Saturn devouring your son. It's really horrific. So I'd have to go to Madrid and figure out how to get it on a plane and bring it back. But
you've been in front of it in the flesh. You've been in front
when
of it.
When I was very young, but I didn't understand it back then. So I would say no, it doesn't count. And then the one that wouldn't have to adhere to the logistics is, of course, Eva Hess. I think it's her last piece that she ever made, which was these worm-like sculptures that are kind of like these sort of life-size worms that are both like sitting on the ground and also suspended from the ceiling. And they kind of like, I think they're fiberglass and some tubes or something. And they're like arranged almost as if it's like a shrine or like a coven about to start a spell or something. I love that piece so much. It doesn't have a title, so I didn't, you know, I think a lot of her works don't have titles, but I do think it is the last piece she ever made. I think about that piece all the time. So I would love
to
just...
They feel like parasites, I guess, in some ways.
They absolutely, yeah, they feel like parasites. There must be a better way to explain what I just explained, but that's sort of the only way that I've been able to describe them.
Love.
Well, people listening can seek out images. And the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
So I think the color that I use the most in this work is this sort of fluorescent pink acrylic, actually, that when I do the pores of the at the beginning, which end up being so very often being the sort of first layer of the work, that fluorescent pink shows. This is really like acidic, kind of sickly fluorescent, and it gives this like unnatural glow to a lot of these moments that are otherwise... that are even if they're like sort of painted over with this more natural color, more fleshy, or you know, tones that are a little bit more subdued, this fluorescent pink is kind of glowing underneath, and it gives this kind of sense of the unnatural to everything. So in this moment, I think that's probably my favorite color.
When you have the elements, the areas where there's staining, where the paint is sort of staining or blurring, does that come first? Is that when the canvas is raw and then you start with the staining, then you pour on top? Or
Yeah, it starts with the staining happens in the stage of these kind of pores.
Right.
So it's sometimes more concentrated and sometimes, and then there's many layers that go into that. So I start with the pores, but then like the staining happens throughout the course of it as I'm kind of, you know, color decisions happen right in response to other colors. So sometimes it'll shift quite drastically. But yeah, it's all about kind of creating these sort of illusions and glazing in different ways throughout.
What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art?
Huh. I don't know, actually. I think there was a lot of advice that came in the form of questions. I think maybe not received, but I did. One of my professors has, Molly Zuckerman Harding, has this manifesto that has deeply impacted. And I think in one part she wrote, "Painting reminds me I have a body." I think that has guided a lot of, you know, I say it often, you know, when I talk to me, her words from that manifesto will sometimes come out of my mouth.
I've got that quote here saying that you said that.
Yeah. Cause it reminds me I have a body. It reminds me I have a body beyond like my fingertips or my teeth that grind, or, you know, the parts of me that I sometimes use, like painting reminds me that I exist in this body. So I think that I would consider that the best advice. Yeah. Maybe I should probably like acknowledge that that comes from Molly a bit more than I have, but
you just have.
Yeah.
The world now knows.
she was that manifesto. And I think the many visits I had with her in grad school were some of the most fundamental conversations I had with this work.
Well, it sounds like painting is vital for you then, to just for your life. It reminds you of living, it reminds you that you're a body, it reminds you that you're present and you need to do this.
Yeah, I considered it like the wound that festered, like you can't ignore it. So you have to address it.
I love that. Well, we are so excited about your exhibition, which opens July 14th called Radical Contractions at the Whitney Museum, and it's running for over the whole of summer. And
yeah, and it goes on until the 29th of October.
Oh, wow. Brilliant.
Yeah.
So many people are going to get to see that. And it's completely free. It's in the lobby as you walk in. You go past membership and it's just between the cafe and then you can see the space.
Yeah. And you can find details at thewhitney.org in their exhibition section. I agree, Russ. I mean, I've seen so many great shows in that space. Diane Simpson, Toyino Jutola. Mm. Salman, I mean, it's an amazing thing. So congrats, Ilana. And
thank you.
If you'd like to follow Ilana on Instagram, you have your own Instagram, don't you?
Oh, yeah. It's just my name with an underscore between my first and last name.
Have you jumped on Threads? There's this whole thing about Threads happening right now. And everybody.
I did yesterday.
You did as well. Everybody's done it. What is the artist? Not saying you're going to speak for every artist, but is there like an artist consensus where people are jumping on it as a new means of kind of communicating their work and their practice?
You know, it's funny. I don't really have any friends that are very engaged with Twitter. Like Twitter is a place where I engage with everybody but the people that I'm friends with. We share tweets with each other, but it's like we're engaged with comedians. Like I'm a huge fan of comedy. So my Instagram is not that funny. It's a lot of art, which is sometimes like, you know, takes itself very seriously. And I love, I'm in like queer comedy Twitter. So I'm trying to find a way to make my threads a similar situation where I can just like, because assuming Twitter is going to crash and burn real soon, you know, how do I translate all of that into.
But it sounds like that's essentially what Threads is. It's just a replacement. And from what I can gather already is that there's way less trolls. And there was some really interesting political stuff today where they were like, all those people that we thought were like a really evil movement are actually hardly anybody because none of them are on here. And they're all being,
wow.
I think the security settings and the way you can control your kind of blocking people and stuff.
You can't have more than one. You're not allowed to have more than one profile in the way that you can on Twitter, right?
Yeah, or exactly. Something like that. Yeah.
You can't go in and out as multiple personalities exactly. And comment on things.
Yeah. And also if you've already blocked people on your Instagram, they're already naturally blocked on Threads. There's loads of things like that. I just think it's going to get rid of Twitter. So bye Twitter.
Listen, bye. I think it's time.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I got Threads like mere hours ago. So I'll let you know.
Yeah, keep what us happens. In those loops.
Well, look, we will all discover that. So looking forward to seeing your show. And thank you for today. It's been a real honor to speak with you.
Thank you guys for having me. This
thanks
was really
for listening,
fun.
Everybody. Thanks, we'll be everyone. Back very soon. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.